KPCW News Time now, 8:15. Good morning. Well, the Park City Board of Education met yesterday and was scheduled to adopt next year's budget, but due to a lack of a quorum, the meeting was rescheduled. In the studio with more, I have Business Administrator Todd Hopper. Good morning.
Good morning.
So two of the five board members were present, three missing. Why did we bother to schedule a meeting?
Well, we had always had the meeting scheduled, and so under law for a budget hearing, you have to give a 10-day notice to the meeting and things of that nature. So the meeting was scheduled, set, notice given out to the public, and budget made available to the public, so we just kept our course.
Okay. There seems to be a serious lack of leadership with the school district. Lots of critical issues here to be decided. I mean, as a staff member, I mean, is staff out there kind of flailing, wondering where the buck stops?
Well, at this point, we've had budget discussions over the last 3-4 months now. So I think the mind of the board has been known, especially on the particular positions that we're talking about adding to the school district. So last night was basically the formal meeting with the public to talk about those deliberations that the board has already had over the past several months. So from that standpoint, there really isn't within the staff concern or apprehension. It's just a matter of going through the formal budget process set forth in statute.
So when does the budget get adopted?
So last night we announced that we would meet Thursday, so in 2 days at 6 p.m. at the same district offices. So kind of like the same time, same place, just on Thursday. And that's when the action of voting will take place.
Okay, so everybody will be there?
As far as I know, there are three that will be there. I haven't touched base with all five.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about this, about leadership. When does our new superintendent, Dr. Gildea, arrive in Park City? I mean, we heard from Dave Gomez, interim superintendent, that he's in touch with her a couple of times a week, but she's still uncertain when she arrives.
Yeah, I was speaking actually with her last night, and her intent is to be here right around August 1st. So we'll expect to see her in that week.
Is there a deadline that she has to be here by, or?
Not really. We'd love to have her here before the school year starts so we can take care of all the pre-year planning. She has responsibilities with her current board, and they're working through an interim decision. As I was talking with her last night, I think they were going to have a board meeting this evening and determine who that interim will be, and that will then set forth the exact timing of when she'll get here.
All right. So the fact that we've got the meeting, the budget being adopted on Thursday, that's still plenty of time to meet all of the state code. And
yeah, so June 22nd is the state code. So we'll meet Thursday on the 21st. We'll be under the wire.
All right. And as you mentioned, there was a public hearing. You only heard from one person, Jim Tedford.
Yeah, he came and was able to ask a few questions of the board.
Yeah. So he noted that city and county taxes going up. And, of course, there's the treasure bond out there. He asked why we are hiring three more administrators for the secondary schools when enrollment, they're only going up less than 1%.
Yeah, so we've been discussing the assistant principals for the secondary schools, again, since January, and have been looking at that. We had a really good conversation with the principals and talked about what are the challenges that they see in the upcoming school year. And one of the things that they had brought out was time to be able to work with the teachers, time to be that instructional leader in the classrooms and at their school, time to meet with parents and be available to students as they have particular needs that come forward. And there just wasn't enough. And so Superintendent Gomez, just a few months ago as we were talking to the board, brought forward some of the statistics of what that ratio is between administrators and students, and found that at our high school and in our junior high, that our ratios are closer to 400-1 on that account. And across the state, it's more like 1-300. So we can see that we were behind in being able to serve our students well and having an impact in their academic careers. And so that decision then came forward that we need a better ratio and we need to give those principals more time to do what they're best at, which is being that academic instructional leader in the school.
So we'll see as we see new growth, then those positions would stay on track with that 1-300?
So, yeah, somewhere in that around 1-300, 1-400, we would be in that range.
All right. In terms of new positions, let's talk a little bit about those. So we've got how many in addition to the assistant principals?
Oh, in addition to. So there's 18 positions in addition to the assistant principals.
So a total of 21?
21 in total. Yes.
Okay. And then how do those other 18 then break out?
So there are 7.5 positions that will be actual teacher positions, so in classroom, providing direct instruction to students. We have another 4-5 positions that are student support positions. So we've talked about the interventionists being available at the elementary school levels. So there's 4 of those positions. And then we have other supports happening within the school. So we have crisis counselor that's coming on, fully funding a position at the high school to work with 504 applications and processing and all that paperwork. So those are supports to the students in the classroom. And then we've also had some supports come into the district as well, a couple of positions. One has to do with our safety coordinator. So we've had a consultant on board for the last several months helping us through all the redesigns of the schools and what other safety measures that we need to have in place. That's just a start. That's not the end. And so the board felt it was necessary to make sure that we stayed on top of those safety measures and kept the ball rolling on that. And so has identified a position that would take on those responsibilities, provide all the guidance and support and direction that we need in that area. And then also with working with the foundation, we receive a little over $1 million in donations. And for particular programs within the school district as well. And so we've gotten to the point that that's significant money, and we need to have a program manager to make sure that we're staying on top of all of the accountability for those grant dollars, making sure that we're achieving the goals of the grants and things of that nature. So there's a couple district-level supports coming in as well.
So with 21 new positions, what does that add to the bottom line?
So the total increase that we're looking at is $5.6 million. About 1.8 of that has to do with the compensation package. So we're in year 2 of a 3-year contract. And so that balance is for positions.
Okay. And so then the rest of it, just less than 4, $3.8 million is for the 21 new positions?
The staffing, correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then in terms of like capital needs, are things going forward as planned? I mean, a few years ago, we were talking about the need to, you know, tear down Treasure and build a new school, but
sure,
nothing's happening there.
So we are in the process of master planning. We have our owner representative on board right now. We will now be bringing on the master planner for that function. We have put out an RFP. We did our review of those applications just yesterday. And so we plan to have an interview round in the next couple of weeks with the successful candidates through that first phase. And so we're on track to have the master planning up and running in fall. And that will then help spell out the rest of the capital story. Where are things going to be? What are the preferences of the community as we build the physical structures around the school district?
Yeah, what's the timeline then on a master plan being completed?
So we're looking to have community input in fall, and then we'll have some more community input early spring, so March, April timeframe. Hopefully that will finalize the master plan for the board to review in that April timeline.
And the thought of bonding then in 2019?
Yeah, so that all depends on what the recommendations are from the master plan. If we're looking at remodels of the existing schools, that may have a different price tag than building new schools. And so the financing will really be contingent upon the master plan and the direction of the needs of the physical facilities. That we can play out that scenario. Let's say that bonding is the solution that we see for financing. April is the right time to have those decisions so that we can pull that together, get a project list together and ready for the public to look at for a bond proposition.
Are we still moving forward with the grade realignment, moving the ninth graders back into the high school?
So all of that is under the master planning process. We'll have that confirmed or denied through that process.
And what about early start times? Is that still on the...
Under that master plan. We want to bring all of those discussions together so that we have a coherent and cohesive plan moving forward.
So we have heard over the years that, you know, it's so tight. Part of that is that, you know, putting in the full day kindergarten and the preschool. So with 21 new bodies, where do we put all of them?
Very good question. We're going through that process right now to see which of the positions require office spaces, which ones will be moving through classrooms anyway, And so we already have the classroom space for those assignments. And we'll map all that out and make sure that we have appropriate places for each of those new staff.
We had talked about perhaps not giving teachers their classroom, but just a classroom space. Are we moving forward with that, or at this point, teachers still have their classroom?
Sure. So we're still operations as we have been in the recent past. I believe that will still come under the master planning process as we talk about what is that learning environment and how do we best utilize the space that we have as we look to increase or improve additional spaces. So same as last year, but there will be discussions in fall to talk about that.
All right. Jim Tedford also wanted to know why we're paying the new superintendent, and he had these numbers. I'm not sure where they're from. A total package of some $400,000. That would be her salary, retirement, benefits, a housing and car allowance. Apparently, what we were paying Superintendent Conley's package was about $170,000. So we're talking about more than twice as much. Are those numbers right?
So what you've described there, that's actually apples and oranges comparison. So the $170,000 was a base salary, and then there were benefits on top of that. The first number you gave out was the whole package. So it's not quite comparable there. But yes, we will be paying the new superintendent more than we were paying Dr. Conley. Dr. Gilday comes with a great deal of experience and expertise, and in the marketplace right now, it costs a little more to get that type of superintendent into a school district. We had also visited with HYA and asked them to kind of sound out where the candidates might be on pay ask. And so we knew kind of where that would go, and it was in the above $200,000 as we were going through the candidate pool. So we knew that we were going to have to pay more than what we were already paying.
Yeah, I think, between the base salary, we're talking about $65,000 between Conley and Gilday, right?
Something in that range on the base pay, yeah.
So, again, I think I asked the question earlier. Are we just building combat pay into that? Or, that's the price of experience? And, get what we pay for?
We absolutely get what we pay for. There's no doubt about that. And in the marketplaces we went into it for superintendents, we knew we were already in the plus 200 range. So we're feeling very comfortable what we're paying and what we're asking that superintendent to do. I hope it's not battle pay or hazard pay, but it's just we have an awesome talent coming into the district, and I think we'll have great benefits come from it.
Yeah, with a salary of over $100,000 or over $200,000, why do we need to pay a housing allowance?
So there's a different thought. Before we began the process, there was conversations and ideas given to the school board that we really, as a community, value having the superintendent living in the community and being part of the community, knowing that the housing can be very challenging here and affordability and being able to bring that individual in. The board felt that it was in their best interest in serving the community to make a residence a part of a permanent package, so that it's not so much buying a house for this particular superintendent, but having that as an asset that's available as we move forward in time, that there will be a resident for the superintendent so they can live in the community, be part of the community, and fully engaged with the community.
All right. And then in terms of the car allowance, there's district vehicles or...
And that's actually what it is. We had a district vehicle available to Dr. Conley. Same vehicle will be available to Dr. Gilday.
So you don't have to pay out mileage.
Correct.
Or
yeah.
Things like that. Okay. So bottom line, run through what this is going to cost us and what we're going to see as a
sure.
result.
So the package that's put together that the board will vote on Thursday night is an increase of $5.6 million. What that represents is for a primary residence, $23 per $100,000 of market value. So you can take that $23, multiply it out by the number of hundred thousands in your home value, and you'll see what that comes out at. And that's an annual cost.
Okay, and then for commercial?
For
and
commercial
businesses?
Is, so same scenario, $42 per $100,000 of market value.
Okay, and you haven't had any feedback on that?
Oh, I've had phone calls, people concerned that their taxes are going up. I think what we're providing as a district is important and will actually bring benefit to the students here in our district.
Yeah. Is the same thing going to happen next year?
Yeah, so we have a 5-year sustainability model. And so what we see is the first piece of that sustainability model is this tax year, and then there will be an equal piece in year two, so 2020, or I guess 2019 tax year, but the 2020 fiscal year.
So a similar tax increase?
A similar tax increase.
Wow.
And again, that's all contingent on, you know, we have our schools now. If that measure goes through and brings additional dollars to the school district, that changes what we might need in the future year. We may have already pre-committed expenditures to what that brings to the school district. So right now, assuming nothing changes, it would be equal, but we have a legislative session that could bring additional dollars to the school district as well and relieve that property tax pressure.
Or take it away.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very true.
Anything else you wanted to mention, Todd?
Nope. Thank you. Appreciate the interview today.
All right. Thanks for coming in. That's Todd Halber, Park City School District Business Administrator. Again, the school board meeting, if you have any say-so, will be, again, this Thursday at 6 o'clock at the school district offices, and then a Truth and Taxation hearing will be held August 14th. Okay.
6 p.m.
KPCW News Time now, 8:32. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher with the Park City Council Thursday. Scheduled to adopt next year's budget as well as look at again at the conservation easement for Bonanza Flat. In the studio, I've got City Manager Diane Foster, Budget Manager Nate Rockwood, and Trails and Open Space Manager Heinrich Dieters. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
So let's see. Work session starts at 3:45 at 4, a final review of the recommended budget. Nate, the proposal, no tax increase, but we will be discussing council compensation. So are elected officials getting a raise here? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, every year we have to adopt the annual compensation, and I believe this year it's staying the same, so there is no increase, but we still have to adopt that every year.
Okay. At the same time, we're talking about the, what, $50.7 million bond for Treasurer? Is that what we've targeted at?
Yeah, that's what we've targeted at. So this is the last budget hearing to adopt the final budget, so the budget is balanced at this point. 2 weeks ago, we went through and kind of listed out the projects and asked council how they wanted to see the budget balanced. And they indicated that they'd want to see that bond amount at 50.7. So that's the amount that is showing in the budget right now. Now, of course, don't put that ordinance on the ballot basically until the end of August. And so there's still time. But as far as making adjustments to projects that were scheduled to be done, that kind of sets where the budget is at, and we'll work a little bit from there.
Okay. And I think the biggest high profile was doing away with the Brewpub Plaza.
Yeah, Brewpub Plaza was definitely the biggest one. Continuing, there was a couple of streets in Old Town that were scheduled to be reconstructed this summer, so those will be pushed off. And then just finishing those granite sidewalks on the lower part of Main Street have been pushed off as well. So those are the major projects that have been delayed or deferred.
For a year or two?
No, really, when you talk about the bonding schedule, that's probably more like 4 to 5. Some of them, you know, potentially up to 7 years. So it does have an impact. But in kind of looking at those projects, assessing the condition that they're at, I think council feels comfortable that will be okay.
And still, when we look at SKIER numbers and saw them go down almost 10%, and yet at the same time, the economic impact remaining about the same, I mean, there's certainly an opportunity for more tax dollars to come into the city, yeah?
There is. You know, the sales tax dollars were forecasted to go up about 5%. Even with the bad ski season, we made just that 5%, but typically we kind of try to be a little conservative on that, hoping that it comes in higher. You don't want them to come in lower or you then have to make cuts. And they're really actually, with the bad season, coming in right at 5%. So don't expect that there's going to be new money, at least at the end of this year, coming in. But that doesn't mean that with a few good snow years that revenues will continue to go up a little bit higher than forecasted.
So what did you forecast then for the coming year then? Another 5%, or
no? We lowered it just a bit, so I think it's at the 3.5% for 19. So we've seen pretty huge growth. I think with Vail and the Epic Pass, I think we're kind of seeing that level out. So I think 3.5% is probably a good safe number to go with. And then if it comes in higher, then we'll go through a budget process and figure out how to allocate that towards services or projects.
All right. Diane, when do we start talking about the language that's going to be on the ballot?
Actually, Nate's the specialist in that area, but I believe it's in the July and August timeframe where we'll do that.
Yeah, we'll talk about it, and we'll continue to be talking about this from today until the end of August. But really, the last week in August is when the state requires the language to be adopted. We might do it a few weeks before that, but it'll really be in that August timeframe.
Yeah, and I don't know if you at the city level are hearing it, but I keep hearing from people asking why we have never explored other options for Treasurer to help buy down some of the cost of the bond. I did hear from the mayor that meetings were held, but they must have been private meetings because I don't recall seeing anything in the minutes about a discussion to allow large lot home lots, you know, 6-10 homes that could knock off several $1 million from the bond.
Oh, that's a great question, Leslie. And that was discussed during actually the in the January and February timeframe when the city council was considering this. And you'll remember when the idea of transfer of development rights, and city council heard a lot from the public on that and then voted to extinguish them, and actually about a month ago removed it from the code, so it is not possible to put any development on there.
Right. That's different, transferring the density as opposed to allowing, like I say, some large lot homes. I mean, what's, you know, adding another 6 homes, I don't know that anybody would even notice. Would
sure.
They?
And that's why, you know, city council, they talk to the community individuals. They actually got a ton of email on this as well. And there were public hearings where we heard from people that they didn't want any development at all. And that's a commitment to open space.
Some are also questioning now, why shouldn't the bond be used for a critical priority of which open space is not?
Well, I think this community has said for a long time it's a critical priority. The difference between a critical priority and something kind of graduating from it is, are we doing a good job on it, and are we on a good trajectory? And I think when you look at the Park City community, the citizens and the elected officials can pat themselves on the back and say, we've done a really good job, and we continue to do a good job. And this may be one of the last big pieces of property that's available, definitely within city limits, to significantly affect density.
And should the bond not get approved, then what?
There's a 10% reduction in the for the $6 million the city council and the mayor negotiated, a 10% reduction in the density, and then there's an expedited planning process that it will go through to have the development built. And as a reminder, there's not an option now for a half development, and I think what the council heard from the community and they continue to hear is, we don't want half, because a lot of the impacts that you would have in the full development, you would still have in a half development, such as the need to build the road and really big excavation, and that a lot of the impacts would actually be quite similar to a full development. So that's why City Council is putting to the voters and leaving it up to them. And we really appreciate people who've come out to public meetings. We'll continue, as Nate said, to talk about these in anything from questions with council. We'll be doing neighborhood meetings. And the city's perspective is, we want to provide information. And then after they vote, you'll see the city sort of go quiet. I mean, we'll still answer questions, et cetera. But at that point, we really do respect. It's important that we say, hey, state law says we can't advocate for it at this point.
Let's move on. Heinrich, the Bonanza Flat easement. I guess staff is not asking for a vote on it, just rather some feedback on the easement, the baseline documentation, and the resource inventory. So when will they vote on it?
Well, let me back up just for a second, Leslie. 1 year ago, we finalized this purchase. So City Council and staff, Utah Open Lands, knew this was going to be an arduous process. We're in the final stretch of that. What we are presenting, and thank you for making note, that we are presenting the entire packet. The deliverable of that packet is the conservation easement. So this Thursday, we are asking council to just provide comment on that final language. Depending on that comment input, public input, et cetera, would probably determine how quickly we return. I would hope that we return within the next month.
So how has the action by the Wasatch County Council impacted this approval process?
So somehow I knew you were going to go there, Leslie. So what we have put into the easement, which I think Wendy will call out pretty specifically, you know, this has been a process where this will be our sixth time going back to council. We've had 10 stakeholder meetings. We've put out two surveys, held some open houses, et cetera. And it is boiled down to what seems to be two aspects, one being the dedication of the roadway with Wasatch County and the other a public safety access point. So staff from Utah Open Lands and the city put two provisions in Section 5, which is the prohibited and permitted sections. One accounts for motorized vehicles, and that's a public safety aspect. What we've heard is that in the wintertime, some of the access points on Empire Pass are difficult. So we've put some language in there associated with that. And then in the road section, we've put language into dedicating the roadways, Guardsman Pass and Pine Canyon to Wasatch County. The terms of which those dedications take place are pertinent in the fact of understanding the scope. What we don't have is anything, any deliverable in the recorded documents to note the size, the scope, et cetera, of those roadways. And we're more than happy to continue those discussions working with Wasatch County on those.
So does this make everybody happy?
Boy, I hope so.
Have you heard? I mean, have you presented it to Wasatch County?
We have provided this language to Wasatch County as well as Brighton Estates. And I didn't check my emails this morning. I'm sorry. I was with my kids. And I will find out about that. But I believe we provided that last night to some members of Brighton Estates and a couple days ago to Wasatch County.
All right. The property allows for horses, hiking, non-motorized vehicles, Nordic skiing. How will those who don't live in Brighton Estates get access to enjoy Nordic skiing?
I think that's one of the components as well, but that's outside of the actual land itself. So we have continually noted that we are trying to focus specifically on the land and the natural environment associated with that. I would assume you're referring to, Guardsman Pass Road in Summit County. Currently, the plan is that people park down at the bottom and they hike and they ski and they walk up how it is. I know the mayor is interested in maybe facilitating that a little bit better, but that's a future discussion.
Yeah. I mean, will there be some winter parking allowed below that lock gate? Is that how it's going
to
work?
I think we need to work on all that together. I mean, collectively, even though we're trying to focus on the land itself to get this easement done, they are intertwined a little bit, but we have to start at one place. With the easement, understanding the parameters that the public and the council's good with. Are they good with Nordic skiing? I think you recall that discussion here several months ago. It seems like that is an approved use. Now we have to work on some of the tangible aspects of access.
There's a section that defines how special events and others can use the property. So are we inviting large groups up here?
We're not. We have, through our evolution of conservation easements, if you look back at some of the Round Valley easements, pretty straightforward. They're about one or two pages. So for better or worse, we have turned these documents into 20-page aspects. The details associated specifically with special events, obviously that's a big item here in Park City, is how we address those through a process standpoint. And so we've had a lot of luck with identifying the current city special event process, that there's a public review period, and then comment is able to be provided by the land trust, the city staff, and then the public and council. And we think that that is a good way to address special events. But I don't think anyone has any intent of holding major events up there.
All right. And then dogs will be allowed on two trails and leash-free. Is this another leash-free zone?
So this is in Wasatch County, so we would have to defer to the Wasatch County jurisdiction on the leash ordinance. I'm sorry, I can't tell you what that is right now, but we would be working with them on that. I would state that it would probably be an on-leash area just to the determination that this is a critically sensitive area, but that looks like something I need to work on a little bit.
And who enforces that, Wasatch County Animal Control?
We would, again, the enforcement aspect has kind of been sort of put on the back burner as we try to get through some of these parameters of what we want to see happen. That will be the next step.
Real quick, Diane, there is going to be a discussion regarding fireworks ban. Have we decided whether or not we're going to ban fireworks?
We are going to ban fireworks effective tomorrow, and actually we'll be banning fireworks, open flames, and explosive devices, which I don't think we allow explosive devices anyway. The biggest question that people normally ask about that, and that'll be effective from June 21 until further notice, I'm guessing through October, because we're looking, it's beautiful now, but we're going to have a frightening fire season. Most people want to know, I have a backyard little fire pit. Can I use that? And you can. What you need to do is contact the building department, and they will come out and take a look at it and make sure that you have a good defensible space, make sure that you have something that arrests sparks, and that it's safe. The worst thing in the world is, you look at things like what happened in Brian Head, and the person who is responsible for starting that fire, his life has changed forever. So we don't want to put people in a position where they're putting their neighbors at risk. So please call the building department. And the following week, we will have actually the Brian Head fire chief coming up to talk to us about, because it's a very similar situation where you have a canyon, you're going to have high fire risk, and he can talk to us about their experience.
All right. Diane Foster, Nate Rockwood, and Heinrich Dieters, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:47. Well, Jeff Rasmussen was recently named as the new Utah State Parks Director. He succeeds Fred Hayes, who passed away unexpectedly earlier this year. Jeff Rasmussen joins me now on the phone. Good morning. Congratulations on the appointment.
Good morning, and thank you.
You served as the division's deputy director since 2012 and then as interim director since March. So I read that you have more than 25 years' experience with state parks. I think it was Mike Styler, the executive director of Utah Department of Natural Resources, who says, if it's not broke, don't fix it. So I guess just given that the fact that state parks have been managed and thriving, you were the natural choice, huh?
It looks like it. And I'm so excited for the opportunity. I had the pleasure to serve with Fred Hayes for 6 years, and he did amazing things for the state of Utah and for our state park system, and really paved the way for a lot of really cool things in the future. And that's why Mike Styler talks about, if it's not broke, don't fix it. We've got some really cool things that we've been working on, and we're going to continue to work on those just to offer really cool things at our state parks.
Yeah. Mike Styler also said that you shared Fred Hayes' vision of success. So what is your vision as director now?
Well, what I want to do is continue to offer all the awesome activities that we've been offering at our state park. But not only that, keep up with current trends, what our visitors are looking for. We have awesome employees at our state parks that are always coming up with new ideas. And our state park managers and the people that we have working at our state parks know best what our customers are looking for, because they're with them every day. So they're always coming up with new ideas of, hey, we need to offer a floating playground or a floating water park at Jordan L. State Park. And it's because of that creativity and dedication that we come up with these ideas. And so I want to just keep on top of that and make sure that we're offering what our customers are looking for.
Utah has 44 state parks, is my understanding, six of them right here in Summit and Wasatch counties. We've got Echo, Rockport, the Pacific Rail Trail, Jordanelle, Wasatch Mountain, and Deer Creek. When we hear about the doubling of the population along the Wasatch back in the next 25 years, is that going to be enough?
If you just look at state parks alone, I don't think so. I think it's going to be a cooperative effort between all the agencies that offer recreation services. We were lucky enough this last legislative session to get some more access to our restricted account, which is built from fees that we collected at our state parks to be able to reinvest into state parks. And one of the most exciting projects that we've got funding for to start with is Echo. Reason being, it's a new facility that we're going to be able to offer to accommodate more visitors and hopefully take some of the pressure off many of those Wasatch back parks that are turning people away on the weekends and the holidays. So we're super excited about it.
Yeah, as the new estate park proposal by the Bureau of Reclamation had several actions, eight of them. When will those be implemented?
Now, are you talking about the development
proposals?
Okay. So we have an awesome partnership with the Bureau of Reclamation, and the reason I say it's awesome is because we're able to combine the expertise and resources from both of our agencies and come up with some really cool stuff to be able to offer. We've been working with them for the past year on some ideas on what we can do at Echo State Park. And again, where we get those ideas started from our local state park managers in those Wasatch Back Parks that you mentioned. And then we've been conducting public meetings up there in the Wasatch Back area to gather public input. And we're getting pretty close to the point where we're able to finalize those plans. And I think people are going to be pretty pleased when they see what's coming.
So when will we see those? I mean, and they've been approved at this point? Or does it still need to go through the public process?
They're not finalized yet. If people are interested in looking at the latest, they can get on our website and go to the Echo State Park page. And on the right-hand side, it has a link that says BOR Draft Environmental Assessment. And if you click on that, it's quite a long document, but down at the end there's some maps with overlays of the draft designs that we've been working on. I anticipate that it's going to be finalized within the next month, and we're hoping to start construction later this summer.
So the report, my understanding, has eliminated the idea of long-term camping. I think we had, about 28 camping sites. We're going to reduce that to 11 year-round cabins instead?
Oh, okay. So you're talking about I'm not sure what it
Red
was
Rock.
Called.
Mm-hmm.
It's where the boat ramp is. And traditionally, there has been camping there. So the proposed plan, and again, it's not finalized yet, but the latest plan has talked about turning that into a day use area. One of our biggest demands is just finding places for people to park their vehicles and their boat trailers. And so that area is primarily going to be dedicated to that. On the north end, where there's traditionally been camping up by the trees where the county road crosses the I'm not sure there's a bridge there. Anyway, we anticipate having a cabin village there with about 10 to 12 cabins. And then as far as camping, we're talking about putting camping on that, what I believe was called the South Beach area. And that area is not currently open. And then there was a water treatment plan on the south side of the reservoir, and we're planning to do a campground development there as well.
Okay. You had mentioned that you hope that Echo helps relieve some of the pressure you see at Deer Creek and Jordanelle. Has that happened at this point?
I don't think it has yet, mainly because with this year we've reduced the area that's available at Echo because we're anticipating construction on some of those other areas. So our goal throughout this whole process is to be able to keep the park open as we build the new facilities. And so we're going to start at that South Beach entrance. That's why that's closed right now. Meanwhile, keeping that north entrance where the boat ramp is open.
The historic Union Pacific Rail Trail is now managed by state parks. You know, somebody brought this up to me just the other day. I mean, we've got, 26, 30 miles of trail. But what about restrooms? I mean, we're inviting visitors to use it as a state park, but are there any facilities?
There are facilities along the routes. I know there's several trailheads along, places where you can start and bike or hike that have restroom facilities. We're going to be adding more restroom facilities as we develop Echo. And so that need should be covered if it's not already.
All right. And then in terms of the responsibility for repairing at least the paved section of the rail trail, which gets a lot of use summer and winter here in Park
uh-huh.
City, who's in charge of that now? I know there's a huge issue with just the asphalt kind of splitting due to a lot of the willow tree growth near the creek there.
You know, I have to confess, I'm not up on exactly where that is or what that issue is, but I'll certainly look into it since you've mentioned it. We have the maintenance being done by a private concessionaire. We've been doing that for years. And if the trail is not being maintained properly, I'll certainly look into that. I don't have an answer for that one. Sorry.
All right. And then Wasatch Mountain State Park, there was an effort a few years back by the state legislature to sell off the golf course. Is that still a reality?
To sell off the golf course? Is that
yeah.
what you're...
Yeah, they wanted to privatize it as opposed to making it public, and it was one of several across the state, as I recall.
Okay, so there was a request by some members of the legislature several years ago to look into privatizing the golf courses, and that request came up again during this last legislative session. So what we're doing right now is working on a request for proposals that's going to be coming out somewhere in the pretty near future to just look at that possibility to see if there are options with having the golf courses or a portion of the golf courses run by a private company. Now, we already have private companies that offer concessions there, like our food service there at both golf courses. And so, you know, where that's going to take us, I'm not really sure. But we've been asked to look into it, and we're working on that, and you'll likely see that sometime in the near future.
Okay. Finally, I just got to ask you about the quagga mussels discovered at a couple of locations here in northern Utah. That's got to be pretty alarming. Anything you can do other than just being, you know, vigilant about it?
Well, and that scares the heck out of all of us. And, you know, it's the kind of stuff that keeps us up at night. And our folks realize how important that is and are vigilant and making sure that they're checking all the boats that are coming in. And I think as the population increases and more people are getting out there and recreating and bringing boats into these reservoirs, we're going to have to be more vigilant. There's unfortunately no easy answers with the quagga mussel issue other than just making sure that we have folks there checking boats as they come into our parks, and that's what we're doing. We partner with Division of Wildlife Resources on that program. They actually lead that effort, and we take care of that responsibility at our state parks. And like I say, our folks are doing a great job at intercepting those boats. But when you say scary, absolutely. It scares the heck out of us.
All right. I need to leave it there. Jeff, thanks for your time. And again, congratulations on the appointment.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, the Promontory Foundation hosting a benefit concert featuring Kenny Loggins. Tickets available that are being made to non-members in the studio with details. I have Foundation Director Beth Armstrong. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Leslie.
Yeah, so the show's when and where?
So the show will be June 30th, and it'll be out at Promontory. And, you know, for the past 10 years, we've held annual celebrations out at Promontory. And each year we try to give at least 150. Last year we gave 180,000 back to the community. The year before that it was 190,000. This year our goal is $200,000 to give back to the nonprofits in Park City. So we sat down with our owner yesterday. He was in town, and because we're having it out at the Nicholas Golf Course, it'll be on the driving range. So we're pretty much unlimited, sort of. So we've increased our number. We have 500 members going, so we want to make tickets available. We would like to get up to 600, so we have about 100 space and availability for 100 more. And our only constraint on space is literally the food trucks. So the ticket includes the concert with Kenny Loggins, as well as a dinner, which will be provided by 7 different food trucks that'll be out at the event.
Okay. How much are tickets, and where can people get them?
Well, because we're opening this to, we really want to include the Park City community. So we're not making this open to, you know, it's local. I'd like them to call me directly, and I'm going to give you my number, 435-647-6831. And you can call me or you can email me at, if you email barmstrong@promontoryclub.com.
Okay. And again, it's Friday?
It is on a Saturday.
Saturday.
June 30th. Sorry.
Okay.
And, you know, we have sponsorship packages still available. So if you have a company out there and you want to be a friend of the Promontory Foundation, give me a call and I can tell you what those sponsorship packages are. They also, the sponsorship packages include a front row table to the event. So they're anywhere from $15,000 to $25,000, but then you also get a lot of goodies that come along with that, including a Friday night meet and greet, very small meet and greet with Kenny, where he'll do, you know, just photo opportunities and things like that. And then at the event, We'll have a live auction for a signed Kenny Loggins guitar, as well as a Monday night football extravaganza with Steve Young in Green Bay. Green Bay hosting the 49ers. You'll be in a suite with Steve Young along with a signed helmet, and it includes airfare. And then one last thing, we're also doing a ball drop at the event. So we're selling balls, and then we'll have a helicopter that will take all the balls up in the air, and then they will drop the balls right before our event starts. And the two closest balls to the hole will get, there are two different trips, 1 week trip to Mexico and in Nuevo Vallarta, and a 1 week trip in Bend, Oregon, up into, Tethworth, which is outside of, it's near the Cascade Lakes in Bend, Oregon. But it's a community very much like Promontory. And so that both of those trips include airfare and would be all-inclusive. So for it's $50 a ball or $300, $400. And then we, you know, a great opportunity to win two great trips.
Okay. Hey, Beth, thanks. I got to leave it there.
Yeah.